Okay, the Haggadah Shel Pesach, really the Seder, is structured around a lot of things, but most specifically what we always talk about is the fact that it has a lot of questions. The Torah even describes the mitzvah on the night of the child turning to the parent and asking questions. We remember and talk about in the Haggadah, four sons who are asking questions, each one of them a different style question, some criticize, some getting an easy response. The Haggadah, for all intents and purposes, starts with four questions, Manishtana. It's the night of many, many questions on Pesach. And my question in turn is, well, what's the idea of having questions with regards to Haggadah Shel Pesach, Seder Leil Pesach, Yetziat Mitzrayim? What is it that, for what reason do questions hold such an integral and central place? So I'm certain there are many answers that could be suggested. I'd like to, over the course of this class, really advance one, but I'll preface by saying two others briefly. First and foremost, questions, by definition, make an experience more engaging. If questions are asked, it means each person is a part of the action. It means they feel that their voice is being heard. It means that they're able to think about it, integrate it into their own life, because they're looking to formulate a question. So there's no question that by structuring an experience which is to be shared between parent and child, or even between a person and themselves, the Mishnah in Masechet Pesachim says that if a person's having the Haggadah by themselves, they're supposed to ask themselves questions and answer. That's just the structure of the night. It just makes it more engaging. So I think that's the most simple baseline answer. Beyond that, there's an answer that I've more than once suggested and heard others suggest, and I think there's a lot of truth to it as well. And that is that questions imply or represent freedom. And by what I mean, and what I mean by that, I'll demonstrate from a memoir that I just finished reading a week or two ago. It was a memoir. It's called A Cold Crematorium. It was written in, I think, the early 1950s by a Hungarian survivor of the Holocaust. And his memories of the first day that he entered into Auschwitz were somewhat harrowing on many levels. But he says, you know, they got up to the gates and they were determined who goes to the right and who goes to the left. And then they were like entered onto, if I remember correctly, some sort of small caravan, and they're brought to the clerk's area. And the clerk was a Jew who's taking their information, but nobody's really certain what's actually happening. There's all sorts of rumors. There's terrible descriptions that are floating in the air. As everyone's just kind of very nervous and uncertain. Their luggage has been seized already. And they notice a Jew who's passing by has already been a prisoner for some time, who assures them immediately, if you're here, it means that you're not on your way to death immediately. So that was very significant to them. But they then, naturally, because that's the way people assume once a person engages in conversation with you, they're open to more questions, began to ask other questions, at which point this person went absolutely silent. If I remember correctly, even responded, in Auschwitz, there are no questions. And what I believe the deeper meaning to that really is that we have the ability to ask questions when we have freedom, when we're capable of sitting back and experiencing it on our own terms, no problem, on our own terms. So then we ask questions and then we endeavor into areas that we're uncertain about. That you can't do when you're a slave. When you're a slave, it's determined what you're to be doing. You don't have the capacity to stop and ask questions. Questions imply you're discovering something that's outside of the boundaries of what you're supposed to be doing. Slaves don't ask questions. Free people ask questions. I remember as well someone, I once had a conversation, more than once, thankfully, with different people, who are very wealthy. But one time, one person really struck me with the conversation, because what I said to this man was, I understand why wealth is significant to you. I really do. I said, you live a life in which you thankfully have bought many things for yourself, for your children, in all sorts of ways that to you are very significant, and that makes you happy, and I appreciate that. I'm not taking away from that. I just want you to understand that in my own life, there's less appreciation. Not that I don't like nice things, I just don't have the appreciation the same way as you. So he said, Rabbi, you got it all wrong. It's a true story. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's the wealth doesn't only buy things. He says, wealth buys a certain freedom for creativity. I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, but you like creativity. I said, yeah, absolutely. What are you talking about? So he said, well, let me just explain to you the contrast between myself and other people who go into work. So other people go into work, obviously not everyone, obviously depending on circumstance and situation. He said, need to go in at a specific time, need to go through the paperwork in the standard fashion, need to go through the steps and stages and conversations and check off the boxes on the standard procedures and protocols on a daily basis, which effectively is, in the scheme of things, a loss of time, an inability to just use their own mind to develop new ideas. He says, I sleep a little bit late. I've noticed he does. He said, I go into the work and I don't have, no problem, I don't have any of those sorts of structures or strictures placed upon me. I can sit back and work on a deal that's out of the box. I can think about something that nobody else is thinking. And you know something? If I spend a week or 2 weeks on it and it fails, okay, I'm not nervous about someone else. That'll kill them. Their whole year is ruined from that. I have the freedom because of my wealth that if I strike gold on this, I made enough money for the next 15 years. But I'm able to do so because I have that freedom, which in his mind was created through wealth. And he's right in his description of it. Of course, in turn, I should be, as a rabbi, looking for wealth, he was suggesting. Not really. But I can, as a result, understand freedom as bringing forth the ability, why is that relevant to this, to question. The ability to think openly about something is inherent, is natural to a person who has freedom and is the antithesis of a life of slavery and bondage. I recently heard along these lines, Rabbi Rimon was in Brooklyn recently. Rabbi Rimon is a world-renowned at this point rabbi. He's the rabbi of Gush Etzion, the entire area. Anyway, he was speaking in someone's home, and he had just one short anecdote. If this is a true anecdote, it's just perfect for this. It's just a perfect story. He said he met a convert, a German convert, some years ago. And he asked the German convert, he said, you grew up with Jews? He said, no. He says, so what was your affiliation to Judaism? How'd you grow up? He said, as a Christian, I barely met any Jews when I was a child or growing up. He says, so what brought you to an authentic Jewish conversion? He said, I went to university. That brought you to Judaism. He said, and I took a course in Talmud. I said, yeah. And he said, and I saw in Talmud, in Gemara, that what happens on every single page, line after line, is question after question after question, with doubt and suspicion and queries, one after another. He said, the religion I came from, you had to accept the doubt. There was no questioning. He said, any religion which gives the freedom to its people to ask questions, which advances and even embraces questions, he says, that's a religion that I know is a true religion. So the second suggestion then, and before I get to the third, which I'd like to spend the most time on, with regards to why we ask questions on the night of Pesach, why it's part and parcel of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, is because to represent freedom, we just ask questions. Free people have the ability to think creatively. Free people have the ability to ask questions, even if there are no answers. Even if I can't find the answer, just by throwing questions out, new ideas begin to percolate. I have an idea which I now stored in the recesses of my mind over the course of time. It'll come to fruition in some way. But freedom brings that forth. If I have to, on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute situation, have to answer to the needs and the demands of others, there's no opportunity to be asking questions. So we ask questions. We even ask the questions of Manishtana, which if you check the Haggadah, doesn't have simple answers. We ask a lot of questions there. Why are we on this night dipping more times than on a regular night? Where did we find the answer? There's no answer in the Haggadah Shel Pesach. I guess you could stretch and you could give a Dvar Torah of some sort, but we don't really answer that question because the point of the night is not so much to find an answer, just to ask questions. We do all sorts of things. So chill. My grandma used to do classic stories with grandma. I've told them more than once, but they're just so good. Grandma Beta. We used to, and I know all Syrian households, I think, do this, you know, during Dam Sephardea, so there's the pouring of my Ashkenazic in-laws, they stick their pinky in, and they take out a droplet of wine. That's the extent of Syrians. We use like a whole bottle of wine, you know, dam, and it's like half a glass, and shardeh, and so forth. I think there's a lot to be said about that as well, about our histories and our. It has a lot to do with the different cultures that I've gotten to meet as well in terms of ability to spend and other. Anyway, so dams. So when we did each one of those, so my grandmother used to have some line. She would say something like umasilan. Something along the lines of, and save us. So my grandmother was a little bit later in her life, close to really not being able to answer questions, but I remember it vividly. We were questioning in front of her why she says that. I grew up, and at this point I was probably 30 years old. I'd heard this for literally 30 years of my life. Grandma saying, umasilan, umasilan, after each one, and we never questioned. And one year we're like, why does grandma say that? So I said, she's saying, God leveled all these makot on the Egyptians, but to us, umasilan, he saved us. And my father, ever the humanist, said, no, I don't think that's the reason. She's saying it because every time we talk about what was done to the Egyptians, umasilan, ya'ani, like, rahmanut, I feel bad. You know, like, even though they were our enemies, let's think about it in more of a positive way. We're kind of accepting it, but pushing it back a little bit. So someone, I really don't remember who, probably Donnie, was like, Grandma, why do you say umasilan? I don't know, that's what my mother said. That's what my grandmother said. It was such a telling moment on so many levels, but for me, it's part, again, of the Haggadah aura, the Haggadah legacy. There's no answer, per se, maybe there is, to why grandma says that, or grandmothers say that in our community, but we ask questions about it, and there's a beauty to that, the fact that we can have conversations about that, ask questions without developing, per se, an answer. There's no deadline, there's no absolute over here. That's what it means to be a free person. So on this night, we appreciate freedom, which, of course, that idea, I mentioned this like we mention all the time. By the way, this was really just preliminary approaches before I get to the punchline on this. But I mention this because we talk about this all the time in these classes. That embraces the process as opposed to the destination. That's so clear. Asking questions means, irrespective of whether I have an answer or what the answer is, I'm just excited to ask this question because who knows where it's going to take us. It's what Judaism has embraced, as I said, forever. It's what, if you've ever opened a page or heard a word from Gemara, it's what it's all about. The rabbis in the Gemara are sufficient, they feel sufficient in ending with teku. The matter should stand. The matter should stand. You just spent two pages on this matter. You're going to give me the punchline? No, the matter will stand. For what? Like what? Then why'd we do this? Why'd you put it on the page? It's so countercultural. It's so against what we do today, in which we expect the answer, in which if this took more than, I was in a certain organization having conversations recently, they were making speeches on Shabbat. There was someone from outside of the community, a Jewish guy from outside the community making speeches on Shabbat just a few weeks ago. And there was a real fear at this meeting that he was going to botch it. Why was he going to botch it? Because I said, in your community, I said to him, you can speak for 5 minutes and get to your point in the last 30 seconds. I think you need to understand, this community has ADHD. If you don't get to your point within the first 10 seconds, they're going to all be done. It was so, it's so telling. It's business mindset. Here, tell me what it is. Don't give me the development. I'll figure it out afterwards. It's a night on which we're really not supposed to be, we're supposed to appreciate that our relationships, especially with God, are predicated upon that freedom of expressing questions, just developing, I wonder why. And there's something beautiful to that in it of itself, so much so that, by the way, we leave Egypt and we're in the desert in this very strange occurrence because the man falls from the heaven and the Pesukim describe how the people turn one to the other and they say, what is this? That's what the Torah tells us because they didn't know what it was. That was a necessary description. I've always felt that is the moment they were free. That's the moment they could say, what is this? You think they said that when the Egyptian the master handed them food? What is this? I was wondering if we were going to get the same meal as yesterday. No time for such questions. No, like, what's it worth asking those questions? If you're in a restaurant and you say, what's the special today? What's in this? You're a free person. You can ask questions. The Torah designates that. The question in and of itself is significant. It represents and expresses freedom in ways that really nothing else could. Okay, so questions number one bring forth a certain energy. They engage us. Number two, they represent our freedom to just ask questions. In Auschwitz, no questions asked. Outside of it, why not? Embrace and run with any question you have. With that, I'd like to advance one more theory with regards to questions, which I think will take the bulk of the class now. So if you have the Chumash, if not, it's great. But if you have the Chumash, I want to just read some Pesukim from the beginning of Parashat Va'era. Beginning of Parashat Va'era mention the famous four Lishonot Shel Ge'ula, the four, what do we call that, expressions of redemption. As a matter of fact, according to the rabbis, the Chachamim, not even the Gemara and the Midrash, the four cups of wine that we have at the Seder are to represent these four promises of God. That's page 28. Do you have it? Is that a Shemot? I don't know. There were some Vayikras mixed in. If it's a Shemot, you're in luck. It's okay. Otherwise, you could just listen to it. I want to pick up in Pasuk Vav. So literally 6 or 7 lines down from the top, page 28, the very beginning of Parashat Vayera. This is God turning to Moshe and telling him, here's what you need to tell Bnei Israel. Here's what redemption is all about. Lachem. Emor li Bnei Israel, ani Adonai. First, remind them who I am. Number one, Vehotzeti etchem mitachat sivlot Mitzrayim. I'm going to take you out from the sivlot Mitzrayim, the torture, the suffering of the Egyptians. That's number one. Number two, Vihitzalti etchem me'avodatam. I'm going to save you from their hard work, the labor. Number three, Vega'alti etchem bizroa netuya. I'll redeem you with a strong arm. God doesn't have an arm, it's an expression. Ubishvatim gedolim, and with fantastic, marvelous miracles, afflictions, punishments to them. That's number three. And number four, Velakahti etchem li le'am, Vaiti lachem le'elohim. I'll take you as a nation to me. And you wonder what's going to happen after? Vehotzeti, vihitzalti, vega'alti, velakahti, vidatem, you'll then know. You'll then know I'm God who took you out of Egypt. That's the description. That's it. Those are the four Lashonot Shel Ge'ula. Right after that, I'll then bring you into the land which I promised your forefathers. It's not an earth-shattering or life-ending question, but there is just a very basic question, which might be simple to you, but I'd like to develop it. And that is, if the objective, and it appears that it is, of all that we went through, is redemption so that you know me. That's what God said. I'll do all these four things, and then what's going to happen? You'll know me. Oh, did we really need to go through all that? Do we really need all the difficulty, all the trials, all the tribulations, 210 years of slavery in order to know God? What is the description in these Pesukim about God saying to us, if you want to know me, vidatem, well, let's go through all this. So certainly once you were already enslaved, once I saved you, then you'll know me. But this is you, God. Did I need to be enslaved in order to know you? Couldn't we have made this more easy? Wasn't this a process that could have been avoided? You wanted us to know you, right? So 210 years ago, instead of Yosef sticking his brothers in Egypt, instead of this new king taking us as slaves and so on and so forth, how about then you took us out, we established homes in Israel, and life was great, and we would know you. It's almost as if you needed all this in order to get to Vidatim. So at the onset, I just want to tell you the punchline before I develop it further. I do believe the answer is, even though I'm asking it as, isn't that crazy? The answer is yes. We oftentimes don't appreciate what a relationship is, certainly with God, with significant others, our spouses, our children, other significant people in our life, with ourselves, until we undergo difficulties in it. I think that's just a reality. We take things for granted. We're human beings. We don't understand the depth inherent in it. We don't appreciate the other side or even ourselves until we go through the difficult times. I mean, we've said it so many times, but the war in Israel in the last 6 months awakened so many people to a God connection, to a connection with others, specifically because of the difficulties. Instead of, oh my goodness, how could God be doing this to us? It was, oh my goodness, I need to turn to God now. Instead of, oh my goodness, we're in the worst state that we've been in since the establishment of this Medinat Israel, it was, let's come together and find something positive from this. So the answer in short is yes, absolutely. Difficulties are, as hard as it is to say, and I don't want any of us becoming sadistic in our own lives and inflicting pain upon ourselves or others, but when that pain and difficulty is there, when the hardships are part of the nature of the relationship, you can and should appreciate in it the depth that you'll discover from it. So, says God, v'hotzeti, v'hitzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti, and only then, v'da'atem. Only then will you really know me. You're not really going to know me otherwise. Otherwise, you'll take me for granted. I don't know. I'm not sure what you'll confuse me with. You'll need to go through this. You'll need the experience of being a slave to another. You'll need the experience of searching. You'll need the experience of suffering. You'll need the experience of being in a foreign land in order to truly appreciate me and in order to actually find me. I mentioned that as part of the beginning too, and really the end of that third approach to the questions on Leil Pesach. I wonder if as well we can suggest the following, that questions begin with confusion, if they're real questions. Questions have a way of darkening our minds. Questions have a way of, I don't know. No, nothing makes sense any longer. Well, what's the difference between the Sadiq's question and the Rasha's question, or the Hakam's question and the Rasha's question? And we'll get stuck on that, and our minds will be stuck. And where were the answers to these Manishtanas, which these are all the additional questions, not even the questions that are in the Haggadah, and why is it that we did? That's all to potentially represent what it means to experience redemption, not to live freedom, like I said before, but to experience redemption in its fullest. Go ahead.
I feel like also, like, unfortunately, the nature of man is to forget. So, like, even if Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, and we were in the Midbar, and then we're in Israel now, and Yoshua is our leader, Navi is the whole story,
there's a cycle.
That comes again over and over. So, I know. Most of the questions could be also a reminder for us of why we do things and our history.
Sure. I'll go further. We don't per se do it in my family, but my in-laws' house, as a matter of fact, I did see them do this. I say all the time, Ashkenazim know how to mourn. They're not so great at celebrations. So if we're looking for the mournful aspects of Yetziat Mitzrayim, they know how to get that right. If you're looking for like the celebration, Syrians know, there's no competition. But for example, my father-in-law passes around all sorts of, I don't know, relics and books and things having to do with the Holocaust and the Warsaw Ghetto and things like that. And this year, Mars Katten showed me this Haggadah from Kibbutz Be'eri, you know, one of these kibbutzim that was struck. What all of these things kind of represent is trying to find, you see, those are national, right, difficulties today. But I wonder if there's a responsibility for us on this night to stop and say, so let me pause for a second and think about what I've been going through and where has God been through that? In other words, it's an opportunity to make it my own. I 100% agree. Yetziat Mitzrayim is supposed to be personalized. It's personalized through these questions which confuse, questions which advance a realization that life and this approach is not so simple, which is really the story of Geula, personally, nationally. What is it that we're looking for? I need understanding. Maybe you need lack of understanding, ironically, to develop some sort of depth. Maybe when you realize, I don't know where to turn. Maybe that's when you find God. Maybe that's when you truly feel His presence most. That being the case, there's a few more steps here. But that's the punchline. That's it right there. So questions, again, to engage. Questions, again, represent freedom. Ironically, questions can do the opposite. It kind of makes you feel the bondage through which you understand freedom. In other words, you're only going to understand the connection through feeling those difficulties beforehand. I did find, however, in this new book, it's called Yitaron Ha'or, that's a contemporary thinker in Israel, he suggests the following with regards to these Lishonot Shel Geula. Again, the four cups of wine, traditionally we attribute it to these four Lishonot Shel Geula. He suggests that if you take a look at this paper. If not, again, you could follow along ba'al peh just by listening to it. At the top of this paper, this is from a different class, this sheet, but it'll be very useful for us right now. At the top of the page, there are pesukim from Bereshit Perek Tetvav. That's from the time period known as Berit Ben HaBetarim. You see, the reality that we were going to be in Egypt was predicted or foretold by God years beforehand to Avraham. Avraham has this famous encounter called Berit Ben HaBetarim, at which point God, catching Avraham in the middle of the night after establishing some sort of covenant by slicing animals in half, gives him the following message. Listen to on source number one here, in Bereshit Perek Tetvav. He first says to him, count these stars and see if you can count them. Then, a few pesukim later, God, Avraham turns to God and says, "Bama eda ki irashena. How will I know that I'll inherit the land?" Vayomer la Avraham, some five pesukim again later, God says to him, "Yadoa teda. Here's what you'll know. Here's how you'll know you'll inherit the land. Number one, ki ger yihye zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. Your children will be strangers in a foreign land. Number two, va'avadum, and they'll be enslaved. Number three, ve'inu otam ba'me'ot shana. They'll be tortured for 400 years. Do you follow? One more time. Avraham is told by God, here's what's going to happen in Egypt. Number one, they'll be strangers. Number two, in a foreign land. Number two, they'll be enslaved. Number three, they'll be tortured. Sound a little bit familiar, at least two of these? What were our four Lishonot Shel Geula? Ve'hotzeti etchem mitachat sivlot Misraim. I'll take you from the torture. Well, that's these words. Ve'inu otam. Right, that you'll be tortured. Ve'tzalti etchem, the third one is, I'll save you from me'avodatam, from the hard work. What else are we going to have in Egypt? Va'avadum. And number three, or number four of the Lishonot is, one more time. Vehotzeti, vehitzalti, we're up to number three. Vegaalti etchem, bizroa netuya ubishvatim gedolim. So again, the first two have been established. The hard work, va'avadum. The torture, ve'inu. What about, I'll redeem you with a strong hand and with punishment to them? His suggestion in this book, he says that a stranger, by definition, has nobody to stand up for them. The Torah even describes this in several places. The Torah says if a family member is accidentally killed, the halakha is, the Torah tells us, that a family member then can ransom the death. You need to run to this Ir Miklat, to this city of refuge. Otherwise, a family member will be Goel Hadam. He'll take revenge upon you. So stay away from my family member. What if you're a stranger? What if you're a convert? What if you're a person who has no family members? You have no one to defend you. I think we can all find cases that we're familiar with. It's more rare in our community because either everyone's related or everybody knows one another. But in the world, there are people who are forgotten and neglected because they have very few family members. They have nobody to care for them. They end up getting lost in the fray somewhere. I love books very much. About a year ago, there was apparently this hoarder of books who died. He was discovered months later. It was just a terrible story. So how do I know this whole story? Because that book guy found out about it because they realized he had maybe tens of thousands of books stored in some sort of storage place. He was tens of thousands of dollars back in debt on that. They came to look for him and discovered that he had died. So this is a terrible story. Almost scary buying his old books. But more than anything, he had no family. That's what comes to mind. The person who has no family has no one to be goel, has no one to be matzil. If someone comes after them, who's gonna defend them? So the suggestion is that one as well. The third one is speaking to, you're going to be ger be'eretz lo lahem. You're going to be strangers in a foreign land. Which means to say that these leshonot shel ge'ula, these responses of God to Moshe, to Bnei Yisrael, this is what I'm going to do, they're going all the way backward. Here's what's going to be in the land. Torture. I'll handle that. Hard work. I'll handle that as well. And you'll be strangers. I'm going to defend you. You're going to become part of me. I'm going to be your family member, so to speak. You're going to be my nation. That's his suggestion. There's something very telling in that for me. I'll tell you why there's something very telling in that for me. Because again, if you just piece it together with me for a moment, what we've then developed is the following, is that God at the beginning of Parashat Va'era turns to Moshe and says to him, tell Bnei Israel the following. You'll know me. I'm going backwards. How are you going to know me? Through my saving you. In other words, in our own lives, we kind of only appreciate, we have a tendency to forget, and we kind of need to be reminded in a very sad but real way through those sorts of experiences. That whole description, by the way, was predicted to Avraham. That's what was being told to Avraham all the way back then. Avraham was told, this is what's going to happen. I've suggested more than once that maybe that's what the words Avraham asking God, remember what Avraham's question to God was? Bama eda ki irashena. He turns to God and says, how am I going to know that my children will inherit this land? What type of question is that? I got this, says God to him. What's the response? Here's the response. Your children are going to be slaves. They're going to be tortured. They're going to be strangers. And then they'll leave with a lot of money and you'll know. I don't understand the question. You know, I turned to you. I asked you for assurance. I almost feel bad. I asked you now. You know, like I almost see Avraham say, like, that was the answer. I just wanted you to like sign off on the dotted line. I didn't need you to tell me. Okay, you asked for it. I'll give you 400 years of slavery. What type of response is that? Unless the response of God over here is you're asking how your descendants are going to be appropriate for the land of Canaan for a relationship with me. You want to know the sad but sobering and real truth? They're going to have to undergo suffering in which they discover me. They're going to have to undergo the hardships of slavery. They're going to have to go through that land. They're going to have the hard and difficult slavery and suffering and feeling like nobody will defend them. And then I'm going to emerge. And guess what? Your people, your descendants are going to know me. They're going to be ready for the land of Canaan.
Do you follow? Tell that to Abraham. He's not saying it like that.
I think that's what he's saying. I have two proofs. Number one, Abraham's question, and what's the answer? Again, Abraham's question is, Bama Eda. God's answer is, Yado Ateda. That sounds like a question and answer. What's the answer? So what's he saying?
He's saying they're going to be, he's not saying Vega'alti, Vega'alti. He's not saying it in that
way. He's not saying, because, right, but I'm suggesting that's the next stage. In other words, he's saying to him, they're going to have to undergo this, and then by definition, they'll know me. I'm suggesting he's hinting it. You're right. That entitles them to the land. The land is the place where we establish covenant. The land is the place where we live together, so to speak, God says. You're right. It would be really cool if he then finished this and he says, and then they'll know me. He doesn't say that.
They're going to have to go through all the suffering, and then they'll
get the land. So it's a sadistic God. In other words, the other option over here is, you wanted to know how? Yeah, I'm gonna beat them to smithereens, and then I'll give it to them. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't ring true. Instead, I'm linking the two, as he did, and I'm suggesting it's the same message. The message is, you're going to have to undergo this in order to appreciate it. I'll strengthen it a little bit more. Strengthening it a little bit more, now it's really the next lines on this paper. The next lines on this paper go to the next chapter in Bereshit. I think we may have even discussed this. It's already on a page. I certainly gave a class on this some time ago. This description of what God just told Avraham in a very eerie way kind of plays out linguistically and thematically in the next chapter. Because listen to what happens in the next chapter. There's a maidservant for Sarah. Her name is Hagar. And the Pasuk says in Pasuk Vav, Vate'aneha, it's bolded over there. Vate'aneha Sarai, Vativrach mipaneha. You know what that word means? She tortures her. You know where we saw that word? Right at the top of the page. What's going to happen to the Bnei Israel when they're in Egypt? Ve'inu otam. Same word. Interesting. Furthermore, this woman, Hagar, the Pasuk doesn't just say that she was a woman who worked for them. It says she's a shivha. That's the female of Eved. What did God say your descendants are going to be? Avadim. Thirdly, Pesukim said they're going to be in a foreign land. Happens to be it's going to be in Egypt. This woman, it says she's not just a shivha who's tortured by her master. It also says she's a shivha misrit. She's a stranger. She's even from the land that your descendants are actually going to go to. Wow. More than that. The following is a cute one. What was her name? Hagar. What was the promise to Abraham? Geri hi ezaracha be'eretz lo lahem. There's really a lot that suggests there's real parallels over here. Now, the next stage in this is, so what's the point of these parallels? So I'm bringing it really down a whole nother direction, so you'll just have to hang on, and then I'll bring it back. This part will be harder to repeat, unless, you know, I kind of review this. But it goes like this. Sarah torturing her. There's a big debate. Did Sarah do the right thing or the wrong thing in torturing her? It's hard to blame Sarah. Ramban Nachmani says she did the wrong thing. It's hard to argue she did the wrong thing, because she then escapes, and an angel finds her and says, go back to Sarah, vehit anita hat yadeha, and go get tortured under her hand. Well, why? That's the angel. I mean, I don't know, Sarah, but the angel of God tells her to go back and get tortured. I'm like, well, what's happening over here? So the suggestion goes as follows. Hagar's wrongdoing is clear in the Pesukim. It says, what did Hagar do wrong? Vatekal givirta be'eneha. The master, meaning Sarah, vatekal, she was kal, she was light in Hagar's eyes. Hagar didn't appreciate her position in this relationship. Hagar believed, and the Pesukim described, she's impregnated, Sarah's not, I'm the person who's really in charge, I'm the important one, you're not. So as a result, vate'aneha Sarah is actually a midrash that suggests, what was this torturing? It was that on the way down to the bathhouse, Sarah said, Hagar, please carry my towels. That's what the midrash says. That's not torturing, unless the word inui doesn't mean to torture. It means to place a person in their necessary place, which might be uncomfortable for them. In other words, Sarah, or Sarai as she was then, turns to Hagar and says, you're not the master, I am. When the Malach then comes to Hagar and says to her, what are you doing here? The response of Hagar is, Mipene Sarai Givirti Anochi Borahat. I'm running away from my master Sarai. Says the Malach, you got it. You just learned the lesson that, by the way, Abraham's children are going to need to learn. Right? You just learned that you confuse this relationship, thinking you're in charge, not realizing that you're indebted and you have to work and worship, not worship per se, but you need to work for Sarai. It's the absolute parallel in story to B'nai Israel and Berit Ben Abitarim. So let me review the whole thing and wrap it all together then. Using that Hagar story, which it seems really clear in the text, that's what's going on. She's misunderstanding her position. She's not appreciating her relationship. She needs to be put in her place. Maybe it was less painful than, you know, 210 years of slavery or 400 years of slavery. She then goes back and gets the message. Shuvil givirtech v'itanita hatyadea. Well, let's push that up to Berit Ben Abitarim. What's the purpose? Says Avraham, how do I know my children, my descendants are going to be, I'm adding this word, worthy, appropriate of inheriting the land? How do I know my children are going to appreciate the relationship with you, God? Sorry to tell you this, Avraham, but they're going to have to go through it. If they're born with the silver spoon in their mouth, they're never going to really appreciate it. How many of our parents told, whose parents told them that, that you don't know how good you have it. I had to go through, and then we tell it to our children, and so, I mean, you know, it's somehow, it just must be all the way back, life was literally, you know, the worst ever. I don't know, whatever. And it was, what I'm saying is, there's a description, and we all feel, and we've all been told it, that you only really appreciate who you are and what you're doing through those hardships, through those difficulties. That's what Avraham's being told as well. And that's in turn pushing us all the way to Yitziat Mitzrayim, at which point Moshe is turned to by God and told, here's the plan, Moshe. Go tell the people, for Leshonot Shel Geula, tapping into these descriptions in Berit Ben Habitarim. You want to know why, Moshe? Make sure you remind the people of this. Vidatem, you'll know through that, Ki ani Adonai Amotzi Etchem, I'm the one who took you out. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you might have mistakes. And I now bring it literally full circle, and in turn, in my mind, the third of our three interpretations to the questions in Haggadah Shel Pesach and Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim is, we ask questions so that, Not that we feel the invigorating light side of, I could just ask whatever I want, but rather we get stuck in the difficulty of the question. Our minds are really churning and turning on, yeah, I don't know. I really don't understand that. Why is that? I really am struggling with that. That doesn't feel good. When you're stuck in that sort of feeling, that sort of experience, you're, so to speak, obviously, in a much more opulent and comfortable way, re-experiencing Yetziat Mitzrayim. You're re-experiencing the servitude, you're re-experiencing the difficulty, and as a result, if you have a revelation, if you have that light which comes from the darkness, it's so much more appreciated. You actually look at it and say, now I can identify with it. My relationship with you, God, now is so much more enhanced. When I'm thinking about my past year through these questions, all the other questions I have, all the things that I've been going through, I kind of now feel your own presence in this. Again, we do have a tendency to do this after the fact. Yetziat Mitzrayim, Haggadah Shel Pesach, Pesach in totality, forces us to do it in real time. In other words, what I mean by that is, we have a tendency when we make up, when the fight is over, when the difficulty is done, we then look back and go, oh my goodness, I was so silly. I should have seen he was there for me, she was there for me the whole way through. I should have experienced that in the moment. And we have that tendency. That's totally normal. See, Pur Yetziat Mitzrayim is like, no, stop for a second. You have any questions? Not only about this, you have questions in life. Do anything that you're going through, let's pause for a second and see if through those questions you can appreciate Vidatem Ki Ani Adonai. And maybe you can find me through that. Maybe you can find one another. Maybe you can find yourself. Again, it's been the story of the Torah as far back as Hagar, to Berit Ben Abitarim, to Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's been, as Raquel said, the story of Judaism. It's been the story of the world. How many cycles have we as human beings gone through with all the same difficulties, all the same mistakes, all the same hardships until we discover the exact same thing? It's true, and you know, kind of sometimes makes you feel like you're stuck in this, I don't know what you call it, a rat race, you know, kind of just going around and whatever, but the opportunity in Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is to kind of get a glimpse of truth a little bit. It's kind of take in that light and preempt the difficulties that are to come, or to appreciate the difficulties that you're a part of, to realize and to experience the question with all that it has in terms of discomfort. I know, not physical discomfort per se, but the questions with regards to emotional discomfort, religious discomfort, intellectual, psychological discomfort. What does that say to you as a person? Does that say to you, I'm going to run from this? Or does that say to you, I'm going to instead appreciate this as an experience through which I can feel something else? I can attach myself to something significant, even if I don't have every explanation and the light isn't fully beaming and radiant.